Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode finds the world record-setting distance swimmer Diana Nyad talking with Oregon's own Cheryl Strayed about Nyad's memoir, Find a Way. It's part of our series of broadcasts brought to you from Wordstock, Portland's book festival, which took place in November 2015. I have to say, I think this is probably the most inspirational event I have ever had the pleasure to hear. Nyad's life has been consumed by ambition and the desire to overcome great odds. She set a record swimming around Manhattan in 1975, and 36 years later, at the age of 64, she was the first person to swim the 111 miles from Cuba to Florida without the aid of a shark cage. I'll let her explain what that really means. She also had a varied career as a sports broadcaster, writer, and inspirational speaker. Cheryl Strayed is, of course, the author of Wild, which is another form of wilderness adventure. Nyad and Strayed greatly admire each other, and their chemistry is incredible. Aside from this being a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation, these two sing, tell jokes, and Nyad even acts out scenes between her and her parents from her childhood.
Welcome to Oregon, Diana Nyad.
And who in the entire world would I rather be in conversation with anywhere, but especially in Portland, than Cheryl Strayed? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Diana and I did an event earlier this year together in Connecticut, and it was love at first sight, right?
My heart is still pounding.
Mine too. And ever since then, I have been spreading the gospel of Diana Nyad, telling everyone how incredible you are. And I mean that so sincerely. You really inspire me. So I'm honored to be here talking to you today.
Thank you so much. And you know, both of us do a lot of things besides Wild and the Cuba swim.
Right.
On the other hand, it's probably what we're both best known for, those two works. And you would think that in some ways there's a clear parallel, you know, an arduous, extreme physical journey that truthfully was more about an inner journey. And your book was so subtly powerful, you know, so beautifully written because you are that writer. And I think similar to me, a lot of people, clearly, the vocabulary is an extreme endurance event. It's
yours was a little more extreme. I just walked through the woods. That's for the record.
Well, you know, just the tail of those blisters was, you know, extreme
enough. That's right. You probably didn't lose any toenails in the ocean, did you?
I didn't lose a thing. I got all the nails intact. but the point was for me is that there are all these eccentricities of that vast wilderness that I crossed. People have been trying since 1950. We call this the Mount Everest of the Earth's oceans. And it is all that. And I don't want to deny any of that, you know, extreme questing. And on the other hand, much more. Always, that swim has been for me about living large, about turning 60 and feeling the grip of existential angst. Who am I? Am I the person I can admire? Much more than an endurance event. And the people who were on the beach that day, crying, weeping, thousands right. of people, and the millions of people who have gotten a hold of me, they're not swimming fans. Some are, and that's fine, but not really. They're people who want to live that message. You never, ever give up, and you will get to your other shore.
That's right. That's right. So let's back up and go back to that day. It was September 2nd. 2013.
Yeah.
You were 64 years old.
Yeah.
And
64. I remember those. It was good good times. Good times, yeah.
And you, when you crawled, walked, stepped onto that beach in Florida, you had been swimming for about 53 hours. I'm sure you know the exact time. What was it?
It was, and don't forget the 18 seconds. It was 52 hours, 54 minutes, and 18 seconds.
Right.
Yeah. That's the tough part, that last 18 seconds.
It was 110 miles from Cuba to Florida.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was your fifth attempt.
You know, that we all love a story. You know, we're all here at Wordstock because we love books. And we love stories. I got to live a dramatic story that spanned 35 years. This dream started for me, technically even started when I was 9 years old on a beach in Florida. But the actual physical pursuit of it started when I was 28 years old and continued and finished when I was 64 with 5 attempts. And people say to me often, well, what if he had made it that first time at 28? And I said, well, you know, I wouldn't have mind missing the box jellyfish stings. But the truth is, in terms of the depth of the story, you know, when you watch Roger Federer, when he wins Wimbledon and he falls to his knees on the grass and he cries, it's not because he won that match. It's because his entire young life has been spent in the pursuit of this excellence. And he, only he, knows what's gone into it and who's helped him. And, you know, when I reached that shore, it was all that 35-year drama and all those good people who quested it with me. Mm-hmm. So it was extremely emotional. And even though I would have never said it then, I'm glad it took 5 times.
Yeah. So tell us about that 9-year-old girl you were when the journey really began.
You know, to even back it up further, it sounds absurd, honestly, but the whole, not even the swimming part, the whole, you know, living an impassioned life started for me at the age of 5. It started young. I had a Greek-Egyptian father, and he was charismatic, dramatic. Every day was an emotional exaltation for Aristotle's zenith naiad. And on my 5th birthday, he called me into the den, and over here on the desk, he had opened Webster's Big Fat Unabridged Dictionary. And he had his hands on the pages, and tears were standing in his eyes. But I was used to that. And he called me, and I thought I was going to get a great birthday present. And he called me, and he said, "Darling, I have been waiting for this day for you to turn 5, because today you are going to understand the most important thing I will ever tell you. Come here, darling. Your name, my name, the name of my people. It is in the bold black and white, the important book, the dictionary. Let me read for you, darling. Oh, first of all, you will go to your little preschool tomorrow. You will ask your little friends, is their name in the dictionary? No, they will tell you no. You are the only one. It says, he says, naiad in Greek mythology. My people. The nymphs that swam in the lake, river, ocean, and fountain to protect for the gods. And this is the one for you, darling. Are you listening to me? Naiad, girl or woman, champion, swimmer. Oh my God, this is your destiny, darling. Well, you know, later in life, we all develop our...
That deserves some applause, don't you think?
As we all do, we evolve and you develop your worldviews. And frankly, and I won't argue any of you who believe in destiny, but I don't. And I came to that fairly early in life, but I did become a champion swimmer.
That's right. But at 9, you first had that vision of Cuba.
Yeah.
Tell us that story.
Well, you know, I was growing up in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I was already a little swimmer, 4:30 in the morning, 1,000 sit-ups every night. And my mother was...
What age? I just want to ask.
I started all that pretty intensely by about 7.
Like most of us.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah, and by the way, never 999 sit-ups.
I'm sure
ever.
Of that. I'm sure of
1,000.
That.
Yeah. And I had a French mother who spoke in a thicker accent than the father. So, you know, it's entertaining, you know, to grow up in a home where you can't understand either parent at any time. And the Cuban Revolution had broken out, and we were fascinated with all things Cuban, as millions of people have been around the world, and there was that forbidden land. And my parents had been dancing salsa at the Hotel Nacional before. And by the way, if I could just throw in a moment as an aside, at that time, with thousands of Cubans emigrating in overnight, literally to Fort Lauderdale and Miami, we were eating Cuban food, we were flying the Cuban flag, and we were, if I can just show you, we were dancing the salsa. You know, I had pretty good little moves. So I am just shocked, niffed to have been thrown off Dancing with the Stars very early in the competition. Thank you. Thank you.
That's right.
After that introduction to the salsa. But I was standing on the beach one day with my mom. And I said, Mom, where is it? I know it's out there. Where's Cuba? And she said, okay, I'm going to show you. Lift your arm up this way. No, no, more to the left, there. It's right there. As a matter of fact, it's so close, you could almost swim there.
Yeah. And you more than almost did. You are still the only person, that's right, to swim it without a shark cage. And one thing I learned in your book, Find a Way, is the meaning of a shark cage. I think most of us think it's only to keep sharks away. What is the other meaning of that without a shark cage?
First of all, I don't blame anybody. I've been in them. I've used them. The way, if you want to be safe from sharks, you go into a cage. It's just a big steel contraption, and they will not get through to you. On the other hand, any large vessel like that, even going just 2 miles an hour, the speed of a swimmer, as it plunks and plods along forward, this is how Jack LaLanne pulled the Queen Mary with his teeth. It forms eddies along the side. Your forward motion and the cage's forward motion brings these swirling eddies. They're going slowly, but once they come around the back of the vessel, they start picking up speed and they start pushing that vessel forward. So the point of a shark cage is for safety, but the truth is, if you swim, any swim in a shark cage, you have an asterisk next to your name if you finish it, because you've had this forward movement. You're going now 2 to 3 to 4 times faster than your speed forward. So that's the reason it's important when we say a wonderful swimmer named Susie Maroney from Australia, powerful, swam Cuba to Florida in a cage. Mm-hmm. And she's the first one to say, listen, I was scared. I didn't want to be out there at night. But she did it, and she was going lickety-split. So it's in a different category.
Right. And you always wanted to be somebody who had no asterisks next to your name. Is that right?
Well, when I tried it in 78, I did have a cage. Uh-huh. But in these more modern times, I had given it more thought. And I had divers. By the way, how will I ever thank those guys? Mm. You know, we're talking about the pitch black at night. We use no lights because lights attract that deadly box jellyfish. It's almost always a fatal sting. I don't know how I lived through it. I think it was on will alone.
Right.
In 2011. An anaphylactic shock, your spinal cord is paralyzed, and I should have died that night, mm-hmm. you know? But the sharks, we go without lights because the lights attracts the box. And then the lights attract sharks as well. So I have a rotating series of 2 or 3 guys, and they dive below me all night long. They can't see a thing. They have no fatal gear. They are just looking for the luminescent eyes of the predators below. And they're always there. It doesn't mean they want to hurt you. They're just kind of, you know, curious usually. But, you know, when you're way out there 50, 60 miles offshore, you can have an animal that hasn't eaten in a couple of weeks. And, you know, as one shark expert said to me, you know, Diana, when you're just kind of kicking along the surface, making a low frequency vibration, you are giving the signal of dying fish, and there's just no more attractive dinner bell to a shark. So my guys dive. They can't touch me, but they're diving with their large fins, and they're exhausted. Swimming underwater at my speed above water is very tiring. They swim, 2 or 3 of them, under me all night long, and they rotate shifts. And they're looking, and they take some little PVC piping. If one's coming up a little too close, acting a little aggressive by the time they see them, they poke them in their very sensitive snouts, their ampullae, and get them away. So as I say, how will I ever thank those guys for putting my life out of theirs?
Yeah. Well, Diana, I'm going to guess that they feel grateful that they got to go on this grand adventure with you, this grand journey. Because, as you know, one of the things that you wrote about in Find a Way is that you had done this tremendous thing, and it took everything in you, all of your will, all of your might, every scrap of strength in every part of your life. But you couldn't have done it without a team. And one of the most interesting things about the book were the logistics of this team that went with you. And yet, on the other hand, you were always alone. You were in this kind of almost sensory deprivation there in the water. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a bit about what does it feel like to swim for 53 hours without stop?
Yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing up this. It's a nuanced conversation because it's true that, you know, you look out at this event and you see this one lone individual taking hundreds of thousands of left arm, right arm, left arm. And unlike the other great adventures of the world, the alpine climbing up Everest and Annapurna, and the running across the Kalahari Desert, and believe me, I have a high regard for all those extreme athletes, and I don't suffer some of the things they suffer, altitude sickness, et cetera, but the one thing they always have is their senses. They're seeing, they're hearing, and they have you know, something input to go with. Whereas you're out there, and forget about the 53 hours, what about the hundreds and hundreds of 12 and 13 and 15-hour training swims? Hundreds of them. They're in the back of the book, and I'm very proud of them, that litany of, I'm sure no one's ever going to read that. I just wanted to put them in. But, you know, it's very, very short time after 5-6 hours when all you've got is this fogged over pair of goggles. You're turning your head 52 times a minute. You've got a tight cap over your ears to keep the heat in your head. So you are in your own little woohoo world in a very short time. I have tended to read lay astrophysics my whole life, and there's nothing like being out in that world and going in to take your feeding break. You can't touch the boat, but you come over close and grab a camelback or grab a sandwich. And as you look back at 4 billion stars at night, you think, just last night, I was reading Stephen Hawking. And he says that at the moment of the Big Bang, how can we even fathom this stuff, that all of this energy and matter that we know of in this universe of ours was literally in the size of a millionth of a millionth of a penny. And when the Big Bang hit, all of that stuff exploded into what we know now, the sun this far away from our Earth, etc. So you don't get to take it in like you do out there. It's one thing I'm going to miss, you know? I'm going to miss that. So you are in your own little world, and I used songs, you know? I used in the middle of the eerie night, when it's 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, just like you like certain music at certain times, your emotions. Well, for me, I had a playlist of 85 songs, and it's my generation. It's Dylan and Joplin and all that. But in the middle of the night, when you don't really believe the sun's ever going to come up again, it's going to be perpetual dark. And it's so quiet, it's eerie. Neil Young was always it for me.
A needle in the damage done, right?
Needle in the damage done. And, you know, most people say, weren't you out there singing Hallelujah? You know, you're singing about heroin addiction, you know, on this big swim. And I said, it's not about the lyrics. Right. It's about that falsetto.
Four
I hear you knocking at my cellar door. With the left arm right. I love you, baby, can I have some more?
Oh, the damage done.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you didn't pay to come to a concert, but what do you think?
So let's talk about that, what you did with your mind, because I think most of us, I know most of us, all of us, I'm just going to say, are absolutely astounded by what you did with your body. But in order to get your body to go to such extremes, you had to bring your mind to extremes as well. And in your book, you write, the human will is far and away stronger than fear and common sense combined. And I will say it might be just your human will that is stronger than... but this is a powerful thread through your book, and I do think it's been the... a sort of hallmark experience, I guess, of your life, that you're always calling upon your will to find a way. Can you talk to us about that?
Two things. One is, you know, any of us know that it's part of the human condition will. I am always amazed. I get to travel all over the world, but you don't need to. You don't need to leave Portland. Right in this room, I'm sure that there are dozens of stories of those of you who have been up against it, whether it's cancer or a disabled child or whatever it is, and you have had the will to decide you're going to live a good life, you're not going to cry about it, you're going to push forward. And I admire so many people, you know, who have grit and courage, who are never going to be famous. I just know for myself, when I was going on the fifth attempt of this, the whole world stamped it now impossible. Dr. Timothy Noakes, the great sports scientist from University of Cape Town, who had helped us so much, he told Bonnie, my head handler, not to just feed me compressed NASA-type goos, to feed me real food. You're out there and you're upset in the salt water. You're immersed in a liquid 15 degrees colder than your body temperature. You're trying to digest out in the supine position, so almost all of that nutrition is going into empty spaces instead of into your muscular, digestive, then muscular system. And he said, Bonnie, take big handfuls of pasta and just, Diana, you come over to the boat, open your mouth. And
you're like a seal. Right?
There's a job waiting for me at SeaWorld, you know, as we speak. But so Timothy Noakes kind of wrote me, as did CNN and all the people who had been with us and found the story inspiring before the fifth time, said, you know, I've done all the calculations. Here they are for you. Here's the glycogen deprivation. Here's the sensory deprivation. Nobody of any age, of any gender, of any era is ever going to finish this swim. And I wrote Tim back and CNN and all of them. I said, you can do the computations all day long, and we appreciate, you know, what we've learned from you all, but you're forgetting the most important element in this endeavor, in anything we all do. And you try to do some calculations for me about the power of the human spirit. Yeah.
Indeed.
I want to go back to the tool. I didn't answer that.
What?
I wanted to go back because we started with the sensory deprivation. Right. You look alone, but it's the team. You know something? 2 hours before the end of this thing, now the palm trees are in full sight. And I asked my team, it's 44 people. This is a true expedition. You've got Dr. Angel Yanagihara, the world's leading box jellyfish expert from University of Hawaii. You've got your shark team I mentioned before. You've got a navigation team. This is an extremely difficult mathematical navigation. And you've got the medical team. I've got my own personal team, which is nutrition and rousing that drop of courage when you don't think you have any left. It's a big expedition. And 2 hours from the end, more or less, when we, you know, we're pretty sure we're making it now, I asked my team to come over and make a semicircle of boats here, and we stopped. And I cried like a baby. And I said, you know, I guess I'm going to stumble up on that beach pretty soon. And I guess somebody's going to take my picture. But don't you ever forget, because I will never forget, that we did this together. We made history together. So many people ask, you know, why did these people stick with it? Failure after failure. Nobody ever quit this expedition. Nobody ever got paid a dime. The inner circle, those 44 people aren't the closest people training with you all year. But for instance, John Bartlett, who died. He was my age now, 66, only 3 months after the swim. He was our navigator, a veritable genius. And I miss him. I miss his mind. Anyway, he wrote me a letter, and I have actually put it in a safety box at the bank because it means that much to me. And he said, you know, Diana, I'm broke. I did this thing for 4 years, and my friends are asking me now, yeah, it was great. It was great for her. She got all this, you know, notoriety. But you've given up your life, really. You have to start over in your mid-60s. And he said, you know, what is that phrase people talk about? There's the talk and then the walk. He said, I just witnessed somebody take the most tenacious, unwavering walk I've ever witnessed, and I had to take it shoulder to shoulder with her because she depended on me to get her across. And you know what? I'd go broke again. And my inner team felt that way. We had a noble friendship, and we had a learning curve of science and technology, and we were chasing what might have been an impossible star. And what does Teddy Roosevelt say? You go ahead. You sit in your comfortable chair, and you be the critic. And this guy over here gets bloodied and dirtied, and he fails, and he falls, and he suffers. I'd rather be this guy than be the timid soul who never will know success because they're not willing to know failure. I want to dare greatly. And that's how our team felt. We wanted to failure over and over again. We might have failed another 10 years, and we still felt that the journey was worthwhile to dare greatly.
Do you all see why I've been preaching the gospel of Diana Nyad since I met her earlier this year? I'm curious, you have always been strong-willed and tenacious, and I'm curious about how that has changed over time as you age. You were the first woman to swim around Manhattan Island at, what were you, 25, 26?
Yep.
And you were, you know, you did so many great things in your youth and in the height of your sort of teens and 20s when you were a champion swimmer. You went 30 years without swimming and decided at the age of 60 to go back to it. And I'm curious about the way that that engine of will has changed over time or remained the same.
You know, it's complicated. I think that if my mother were still alive, she would say that you could see that drive and that personality of will very young, like, well, maybe a toddler. As you have children, you see the personality is there, regardless of who you and your husband are
right.
Early. And then I, you know, frankly, and I don't mean to throw this out quickly because, you know, it can be upsetting, but I only say it. I went through sexual abuse as a child, and I only say it because I'm very aware of people suffering much worse and much more. It just happens to be my life. It's my reality. And I think that I, my will was much more showy. It was much more verbal and get out of my way. I needed to have that tough armor. I was so intent on being something other than that sexual victim when I was a teenager and when I was in my young 20s. So I had more braggadocio about me. And I learned with love and with understanding as I got older, especially into my 50s and now what I consider the prime of life, my 60s. Yeah. I learned that actually this quiet will is even stronger than that braggy will. And so I am just as fierce, like a badass, as I always was. But I don't need to talk about it. I don't need to show people. I don't need to be the center of attention at every party. And I did, you know. I was very much, look at me. I'm not that victim, you know.
You wrote very openly in Find a Way about experiencing sexual abuse by your father and a really important coach that you had in high school. And I'm curious about how, you wrote about how it took you to your 50s before you began to really heal. Do you think in some ways, how did that impact your life when it came to that sense of driving forward?
Well, I think it's as I say just now, I think that I put on this coat of armor, mm-hmm. You know? That's what I did to survive, to protect myself. I put on this coat of armor. You know, I hope you can make it a quick story, but I wish I could tell you the backstory. It would take longer, but I became friends with a man who suffered an unreal tragedy as a child. And he was working with a therapist, a psychotherapist in Tel Aviv. And he never met her. It was like those long distance, you know, phone therapy. And I told him a little about, you know, that I was still angry and I was still self-angry. It's a lot of the syndrome is you blame yourself and, you know, still going into these self-rages over that whole sexual abuse. Why didn't I stop it? I was such a strong person. And why didn't I throw that guy up against a wall and go tell the principal, go tell my mother? And it's complicated. You know, you feel you deserve it. You are paralyzed through it. It's just a helpless feeling. So I can't go back and be the person I am now and take care of it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said to me, you know, this therapist in Tel Aviv had helped him so much, and he thought maybe I should talk to her. And I had tried lots of different ways, including just talking to my friends and going to mountaintops and writing. And, you know, I don't think you ever, it's an imprint. You know, everything that ever happens to us is this, we are the sum of our experiences, aren't we? So I can't be the person who never went through that, although I am quite free of it today. But this woman from Tel Aviv, she says, now listen, I deal with past life regressions. And she said, I know you don't believe in that, but don't worry about that. You don't have to come to my place of belief. Just suspend your disbelief. Just as you could learn from a fable, you know, you could read something from old times that clearly you don't think happened in reality. Doesn't matter, you can't extract the truth from the essence of that fable. I said, okay, I'm game. So I'm in LA, like in the lotus position as we do in LA, you know. sitting on my couch, and she's in Tel Aviv, and she says, I have this strong feeling about you. In the Middle Ages, you were male, and you were in this village, and you had a lot of female friends, not sexual friends, just friends, and war broke out, and this you know, bloody tribe came in, took over your town, slashed people's throats. It was awful. It was violent, and your particular torture... So I'm into it. I'm like, I'm back in the Middle Ages, you know, and I'm, you know, I've got my my male coat of armor on, and, you know, and she says, your particular torture was that these people tied you down and back, you were helpless, and they raped all your good female friends right in front of you. They killed some of them. It was savage, and you couldn't help them. So now the war's over. People are trying to heal. A lot of people have died. What do you do? Do you go around to your buddies, to your female friends, and call them whores and, you know, find them despicable people? Of course not. You wrap them up and tell them how much you love them and how you respect them. And this was not their fault. Some crazy group of hoodlums came through town. I said, yeah, that's what I did. I went over and I was a mensch. I held him and whatnot. And she said, I don't know where she's going with this at all. I didn't see through it. I was really in the Middle Ages with her. And she said, so why can't you do that for your little girl? Why are you so tough on her that this was all her fault and you've got to live it and feel the pain through it all these years? Why can't you go to your little girl and say, some two crazy guys rode through town and got a hold of you, and they got a hold of a lot of other people, by the way. None of it was your fault. And just leave them behind and respect and love that little girl. So I've just had a lot of momentary aha moments of moving past it the best I can, you know?
Do you think that experience... We want to cop at everything you say because we love you.
I know, it's a very nurturing crowd.
It is. Well, welcome to Portland.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you should see in Brooklyn. They're like, all right, already, past lives, okay. You know, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I want to get, you know, shortly really after this thing that you just described, where you had this sort of epiphany kind of moment in your healing, right, and in your life, you decided to start swimming again and pursue this old dream. But you never lost that deep connection, even in all those years that you weren't swimming. You stayed in top physical form. Is that right?
Always. I mean, that's my value.
It's
I think
your value.
Since I've been 5 years old, even on a day with the flu, even, you know, Cheryl knows better than I do what this book tour is like. It's a city a day, literally, for 30 days, and you feel gratified that the publisher is sending you out so you can talk about your life and your book, and hopefully we have a connection. But it's tiring. I was just thinking on the plane today, I think this is my 10th day of sleeping under 4 hours a night. And you just get up for it. You know, look what a beautiful crowd you are, what a beautiful place to be with Cheryl Strayed with you. It's such a privilege, obviously, but it is tiring. But I will forego if there's a night like last night, and I see that I have a choice of getting 5.5 hours sleep or doing a kick-ass workout and getting 4 hours sleep, I'm gonna go for the kick-ass workout.
So you hear this, fewer people clapped
Few,
for that.
Like yeah. you.
Some people will just go back to their hotel room and have a glass of wine and sleep.
Yeah.
Woohoo! So
I'm shocked.
Now, one of the sort of I have two questions. One is I want to know, and I think you all would join me in this. You know, what is a sort of typical Diana Nyad workout? That's question one. But one of the I'm sort of afraid to know, aren't you all? But one of the things that I was very amused by is one of the books I remember very strongly from my sort of teenage years, my youth, is this Jane Fonda workout book, right? Remember that Jane Fonda? Well, very few people know that Diana Nyad also published an exercise book that same month that Jane Fonda came out with hers.
The same day.
So tell us about that book, Diana.
No. A lot of people didn't get to see that book. Here I am, probably, you know, the fittest person in America. And so one of the publishers in New York wanted to do, you know, my version of fitness and what to do, and called Basic Training for Women. And we've done it. We've shot the cover. It's all done. And we're all in the publisher's big conference table in New York. It's done. It's in the fall. It's going to come out April 22nd in the spring, because summer, you know, getting ready for your bathing suit kind of thing. And there's a little meek dog knock at the door. And a young woman opens it. She works at the publisher. She said, "I'm sorry to bother you guys. It probably doesn't mean anything, but I have a friend who works over at Simon & Schuster, and they evidently are coming out with an exercise book themselves on April 22nd by Jane Fonda." It's her first one. Remember the one where she had her legs up in the
yes.
air like this?
Yeah.
Like this? With the leggings, and you know, with the big blue eyes, and kind of like, you know. Well, the door shut, and we all took, like, 5 seconds. We sat around, and we went, "Who in the world would read Jane Fonda for exercise?" Well, I was on that book tour, and first of all, mind you, the night before the book tour started, six weeks, every city in America, and Jane and I on almost all the same talk shows, one after the other. The night before, I was sleeping in my apartment in New York City, and the phone rang, like 2-3 in the morning, and I reached over, and something on my neck snapped. And have you ever had that stiff neck where you can't even hold the weight of your head up? I wore a neck brace for the whole 6 weeks. Yeah. Yeah. And I'd sit at a talk show like this, I couldn't even turn my head like an... And as they count down, if you were the interviewer, they'd count down. And we're going live in 5, 4, 3. I'd rip off the neck brace and throw it up. And I'd sit like this. And an interviewer like Cheryl named Debbie would say, "And I understand, Diana, that flexibility is very important to you, too." And I would say, "That's right, Debbie. It's really important to keep your spine flexible." And then when I'd get off, they'd clear off the set and put a mat out for Jane Fonda, who'd come out. I mean, she's the most beautiful woman in America. And so she thought it was funny. We'd wind up at bookstores, and there'd be like one guy in a raincoat waiting to talk to me. And her line, you know, would be out the door, around the block, and, you know, down to the airport to talk to Jane.
I'm sorry about that, Diana.
Yeah.
Okay. So part one of my question, what's a typical workout for you these days?
You know, Cheryl.
You got... Uh-oh. Are you going to do a plank now?
The least we can do, you don't have to, you know, run, you know, the Western States run. You don't have to swim from Cuba to Florida. Just walk every day. And I'm preaching to the choir in this town. But most of America sits all day and all night. We don't move at all anymore. So that's going to be the next. So right now I'm walking a lot. But I get in my hotel room, for instance, and I'll do 1,000 of these. You go down over to the side, you jump back, you jump out, jump up, one, jump up.
Wow. No.
No, no, no. I'm wearing heels.
I'll sing Neil Young with you, but I'm not going to do one of those.
Just one.
Well, not until you... I would need to be trained to do it. You know, very impressive. You know, that's a beautiful, beautiful thing, Diana. I mean, I think you're right. Obviously, I agree with you about this walking business. And one of the things I always say is not only... I mean, we have all these physical reasons to take walks, but mental, spiritual. Whenever I feel bad, you just walk out the door. 15 minutes later, you feel better. No matter how bad it is, a walk will make it better.
That's it.
And so tell us about this plan.
Well, you know...
That you're doing a walk across America?
Well, during the writing of the memoir, mm-hmm. all I read was memoirs. I want to read everything. Like you guys, I'm a reader, and I read memoirs. And by the way, Wilde was my first choice. And after reading all of them, my favorite of all of them. Yeah.
Thank you.
No doubt.
Thank you.
100%. But I read memoirs because I wanted to be inspired and see what other people did with their life stories. Well, right now, I'm reading all about walking. I mean, I'm reading the anthropological books of when we came from being on all fours to standing up. We walked out of Africa. We walked to Asia. And, you know, we have been bipedal nomads most of the human arc of existence until recently, until we became techno types. And so we're not walking. And it's so many people from Thoreau to Rousseau, et cetera, have talked about walking and thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, Steve Jobs used to do a lot of his meetings, as you will probably know from here, walking. He'd say, meet me, and we're going to take a walk around. So I've just been thrilled. I don't have much time right now on the book tour, but before that started, and soon when this is over, I put on a headphones, I listen to a book, and I go out and walk around London for 4 hours mm-hmm. and just, you know, listen to the history of walking and other people talking about walking. So I'm finding it a real, you know, sort of leisurely and outdoors kind of turn on, you know, to be outdoors and covering ground. It's fantastic.
I agree.
You know what we're going to do? Listen to this.
We're going to go for a walk.
Yeah.
And then have a drink. Yeah.
You know, somehow I feel this crowd's on your wavelength.
They are. We did that last time we saw each other. No, you had a drink with me.
No drinks.
You didn't? You had a cheeseburger.
I had a cheeseburger. Why not? Why not? But we are going to start this walk and imagine the empowerment of these kids. And I'm going to get your daughter, Bobby, to do this. You're about to sign up for this. Okay, Bobby? You ready? You ready? We are going to start out the gates of Disneyland in L.A. with 25,000 kids under the age of 14. These are the kids, you know, every day we hear the egregious numbers of childhood diabetes and, you know, kids addicted to their screens. These kids are going to feel like they were the ones who launched this historic Everwalk by walking the first 5 miles. It's going to be fantastic. And then we're going to do an Everwalk every summer, but shorter. Like Portland to Seattle.
Yeah.
And then the next year, Portland, Maine to New York City. And then the next year, Chicago to Minneapolis. And after 10 years, Everwalk's going to be a happening. And people are going to say, are you doing Everwalk this summer? I'm going to go and take a four-day weekend and join them at this point. A million people aren't going to go cross-country. They're just going to be a million by the end who will have joined us.
That's right.
So I'm making eye contact. Bobby.
All gonna go.
Bobby, do I have your commitment for Disneyland? That's how we get kids going. We say, do you want to come to Disneyland? Then we tell them about the 5 mile walk after that.
So sadly, we're getting short on time. I have two more questions for you. One is, I want to know, what's hard for you?
Letting people down.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I just, if on my gravestone it could say she was the best friend who ever lived, that would touch my heart. And if I feel I've let a friend down and I haven't been there when they've been sick or when they've needed me, I suffer over it. So I try to show up, you know,
mm-hmm.
for my friends, yeah.
So.
And being short of words is hard for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet that never happens.
I can't do it. I can't, that's why I can't work on Twitter. How can you say anything in 140 characters? I know I can't. I have that that quote on my desk that says, I would have written you a shorter letter. I just didn't have the time. You know, so I admire people. You know, I don't know, poetry, actually, and the thing that sparked me when I turned 60 about turning back. I wasn't turning back to be a marathon swimmer again. I wanted to chase something big that was going to make me have to dip into every fiber of my potential. And that's what Cuba was. It wasn't a marathon swim. And I'm not good with poetry. I don't know about you, but when I read poetry, I say, why don't they just say it? Why don't they use a few more words? But I had read Mary Oliver.
Right.
And I had read that poem, The Summer's Day. And I needed it. When I turned 60, I went in my library and I fished around. I found it. And for that whole month, the August of 2009, I dragged out those last two lines. And it was like the virtual mirror. It's the most powerful rhetorical question I can imagine. Tell me, what is it you're doing with this one wild and precious life of yours? And I knew I needed that question. I knew I needed the answer. And the answer was Cuba.
You end your book referencing that quote. And you say that you're somebody who cherishes a bold journey.
Yeah.
And you're doing this wonderful walk across America. But what's the next bold journey for you that's about you and your life?
You know, the walk, the ever walk, to me, is like it's catching fire for me because I see it as this leading, it is epic. I see it as this leading our entire nation toward better collective health. So Cuba was my private Idaho, even if no one had ever known about it. And it turned out, you know, a big population responded to it and followed it and rooted me on. But I was doing it anyway. It was for me. It was very personal. Mm-hmm. Whereas this walk is truly about caring about people. It makes me sad when I see people, you know, unable to enjoy their bodies and unable to enjoy nature and mm-hmm. to feel, you know, you see toddlers playing. We should be like that. We should feel alive and fun in our bodies, and we don't much anymore. So I just see, you know, I'm 66 now. When we finish 10 years of Everwalk, I'll be 76, and I'm sure I'll be a young, vital 76. But I would like to see me leave a legacy over these 10 years of feeling not at an incredible fitness level, but at a movement level that excites our endorphins and gets us outdoors again. And I would love foreigners. Do you see foreigners? Do you have friends who come to this country and they say, my God, what's happened to the Americans? They become huge and they don't do anything. They don't walk anywhere. I want them to come over the next few years and say, do you see those crazy Americans? They walk everywhere.
They all look like Jane Fonda. Or Diana Nyad. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you,
sharing
Cheryl.
Your heart with us.
Thank you.
That was Diana Nyad and Cheryl Strait in conversation at Wordstock, Portland's book festival in 2015. The Wordstock 2016 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 5th in downtown Portland. For more information, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.